You're listening to the Manufacturing Ignition podcast. Keep updated with the latest news, recruitment advice, and hot topics within the UK manufacturing industry. Sponsored by Bonfire Recruitment, helping manufacturing leaders across the UK to attract the best talent for their manufacturing company. Ignite your business or career today by visiting www.bonfirerecruitment.com. Here's your hosts, Terry Mallin and Scott Buchanan.
This week, latest news within manufacturing sector across the UK. Scott, over to you.
Thanks, Terry. Well, this week in December, it looks like car makers are driving the longest period of manufacturing growth within the UK since, I think, since the year you were born, Terry, 1994. Is that fair?
I was 1996, Scott. You're getting it wrong again, you know.
You wish. apparently, automotive and pharmaceutical output is soaring. But mining and energy and construction, if you from that industry, are dragging down the total industrial production, says the Office of National Statistics. So Britain's car factories are helping drive the country's manufacturing production to its longest period of growth in more than 20 years, which for me, hearing that is incredible. You know, 20 years, Terry, that's just, you would not relate that. You know, if you listen to any of the news that you see, you know, or hear, there's not really too much positivity coming out. So 20 years worth of, you know, the biggest growth within that period is incredible.
Yeah, no, I'm finding that interesting, Scott, because obviously transport manufacturing is a big sector, you know, in the UK. Not as big up north in Scotland, but certainly down south. And, you know, we probably don't hear about it enough unless we're dealing with our particular clients that we work with. But I know the likes of, so your Nissan, your Jaguar Land Rover, Aston Martin, you know, they should all be posting reasonable numbers this year off the back of what that article's saying.
Yeah, and reading here, apparently the last time that manufacturers stick together an unbroken run of 5 months was from December 2013 to May in the following year. So, you know, that's really good news for what's going on. And I guess leading on to the next part of the news, whereby I think it's how long this you know, the growth factor will be there because of what's happening with the political situation with Brexit. Okay. All right. So kind of leading on to that, I was reading an article, it was a chap, Austin Mitchell, was writing a note in the Guardian. I don't know if you're an avid Guardian reader, Terry. Have you looked at that person now?
No, I've the answer's no.
what Austin was saying, right, is and apparently he's a former Labour MP for Grimsby, which is, as you know, is quite a heart of manufacturing. Actually, there's a lot of good factories down in Grimsby, but he was highlighting the fact that actually that they need to rebalance the economy and that Brexit is just a distraction to the real problems. And if you go on and read, he's taught the idea that that we consume more than what we produce, leading to an annual balance of payment deficit rising above 6% of GDP. So everything's been dropping. Okay. And that means that the manufacturing sector has shrunk to 1/10 of GDP, which is almost pathetic.
So Scott, let me get this right then. So with regards to, he's saying Brexit is a distraction, but there's bigger problems, and that bigger problem is on the basis of there's more demand than what we can supply potentially in the future.
What he's saying is that the solution is to rebalance an economy excessively dependent on finance and services, by widening the manufacturing production base and making it more competitive. You see, so I think in essence he suggested that all the, you know, the investment, and we touched on this last week, around, you know, the manufacturing is not getting the companies within manufacturing are not getting investment to their hands, and this kind of ties in with that.
Yeah, and putting everything together actually over the past couple of podcasts, Scott, obviously there's other ways for manufacturing businesses to be more productive. Using sort of latest technology that's out there, you know, more automation, and, you know, that can only help with regards to, you know, the increase in demand in the future as well, because if factories are more productive and operating more efficiently and the output's a lot higher, yeah, you know, then aye, okay, I get that, right, okay, interesting.
Yeah, and then to kind of tie in with that political point, it looks like UK manufacturers are pushing Prime Minister, the beautiful Theresa May, to give them a key role in the actual Brexit negotiations so that they can defend the interests of business as Britain leaves the European Union. You've probably seen on the news, Terry, there's a lot going on around how we're all going to work together or not, I guess. And
to be honest, Scott, I've not listened to a word you just said there. I just heard you saying the beautiful Theresa May, and I'm sitting in the I'm in shock. So I didn't even hear what you said after that.
Do you not have a printout of it beside your desk as well? I'm sure it was you that I saw with a printout. No,
you've said this before. You says I've got a printout of you next to my desk. I've got a.
That should be a 3D printout. But no, so to me, yeah, I think that the chief exec of the manufacturing lobby group, EEF, said that because of the complexity and the integrated supply chains that we've got, it's really important that business sit alongside government in working out the details. So that, you know, in his world, you know, in an ideal world, nothing would change for business. And I think his point must be, you know, there's plenty of banks, I'm sure, are working closely with the government. But actually, how close is the government at the moment to working with, manufacturing industry across the board, irrelevant of sector? I know they're working to a point with the big ones. Well, I guess you understand that with what we've read in the news with the automotive piece. But, what about the food economy, the drink economy, the SME manufacturers that are coming through the ranks? Yeah, I think there's certainly work to be done. So, I'll get you a picture of Theresa May in the post for you. No worries, I'll make sure you come.
Okay, thanks very much. Moving on to the some food news, Scott. Some food manufacturing news. So, obviously, we're on the run up to Christmas. We're 2 weeks out, less than 2 weeks now, and that's scary. Actually, it's like a week and a half. I need to get my Christmas shopping done. So, the Co-op, and I did see on social media, Aldi as well are going to donate. So firstly, the Co-op's going to donate 100,000 meals over the Christmas period to vulnerable people in the run-up to Christmas. So that's very positive news. And I know Aldi put out something on social media where what they're looking to do is once all their stores close at 4 o'clock on Christmas Eve, any stock that they've got, they'll give away for free that's not been sold. So literally, you could go to Aldi and whatever's going to be, I'm guessing, going to be out of date at some point. They're going to give it out, which I thought, do you want to know what? Hats off, that's great. That's, these things, talking about helping the local communities, using products that are potentially going to waste.
I think it's very easy for certainly for us to forget, I'm sure others, whereby, we hopefully get a nice warm house and, some good food to eat. And actually it's, there can be food sitting in exactly that in a supermarket or similar where, no one's using it. And actually, it probably will be chucked out because no one will probably want it after the Christmas period anyway. So that's really quite forward thinking with these. Was that the Co-op and Aldi, was it, Terry?
Yes. So Aldi's closing their doors at 4 or whatever it is on Christmas Eve, and the Co-op is donating actually 100,000 meals over that period. But I know the Co-op does a lot of work throughout the year, so it's not just focused on sort of Christmas, but the end of the day, these gestures and support to local communities go a long way. So yeah, hats off to both those particular businesses. I'm sure there'll be other businesses that are involved, but those two are the two that's kind of stood out to me in the last week on the sort of latest news. And you remember we were talking about the awards, Scott?
We do like an award ceremony, Terry.
We do. And I know in a couple of the podcasts I've mentioned the Young Talent Award is within food manufacturing, and the same name keeps popping up, which is Cody Glethill, who works for Coca-Cola. So actually, I noticed back up in the news again, back from, I think she won an award for the Food Manufacturing Excellence Awards in London back in November. And I did a wee bit of research because I was like, well, how does this person, been nominated for this amount of awards and had such a success over the year?
Right.
And it's in a very, very competitive field, as you would as you know anyway, Scott, you know. One of the big things, so Cody Gledhill is a year three electrical engineer working for Coca-Cola, made a big contribution to an automation project that Coca-Cola were driving, and that actually saved 7 tonnes of carbon dioxide emissions. Wow. And £14,000 over 4 years. So very environmentally focused. But what most importantly that the judges were impressed was her positive attitude, the eagerness to learn, and then combined with obviously that track record of improving efficiency within manufacturing. But kind of putting all that together, that's why this person is actually standing head and shoulders above the rest at the minute from the young talent out there in the manufacturing sector. So the key thing is, you know, for business leaders that are listening, is to, you know, a lot of the guys I'll be giving people a lot of opportunity, young people, but actually make sure that they've got projects that can bring the best out in them and give them the training, development, support, and then actually in the end, nominating these people for these awards, you know, it can only do good for your business and more importantly for that person's career. It's always good to get that sort of self-satisfaction.
Very much so. I think it's a valid point, Terry. I think most people that are passionate about, you know, what they're involved in, they want to do a good job. And, you know, if it's such an innovative idea and that's the thought process, then it's helping. It's, you know, in that case, it's potentially helping the, you know, the world and from an environmental perspective, and to be associated with that, it's great news.
All positive. So kind of wrapping up that then, Scott, this week, guys, seems quite interesting, some interesting news out there. I know things will be quieting down in the next week, but we'll look to gather as much information for podcast. This week's Manufacturing Ignition hot topic is problems with 3D printing. And this closely follows what we covered last week on episode 7, in which we discussed the benefits of 3D printing within your manufacturing company. So all we've kind of noticed in the news is all the positive aspects of 3D printing, how it can benefit your business. So what me and Scott have decided to tackle head on is what problems is there with 3D printing? So this will be quite interesting, Scott.
As you know, it's been quite a week for both of us, in fairness. So I'd like to say I've been studying this late at night, but yeah, I think one of the things that seems to be pretty common with 3D printing is the same issue I've had with printing, which is related to, you know, I guess the cartridges that you would use, and I think it seems to be called the filament reel within 3D printing.
Yeah, it's like a plastic. I think it's like fishing line, I think it is. I think that's what it looks like from my understanding. I've got one in front of me actually, but it's boxed to go out to a supplier, but it looks like fishing line, I think, and you know, you have to, it's the same as ink. Aye. Within your own printer.
So I guess that in there, that must be the technique, I guess, of making sure it's at the right, you know, the right, you know, that the nozzle is too close to the print bed, and making sure that the nozzle is also open and the depth of it is correct as well. So that, I guess, where I thought, and maybe you want to speak to the people that we gave the 3D printers over to, actually, for the competition we did, actually, yeah, Getting some feedback on how easy is it to work. Because I would have assumed, you know, you buy one, you put in the relevant design coordinates, and away you go. But reading between...
I think it's a wee bit more difficult. It will be more difficult than that, and I've done a wee bit of research on it, because I was actually going to buy one myself, do you know that? But as I said last week, but I've not. But I will do. They're rather expensive. But yeah, I mean, looking at it, you hook it up to your PC, you put your design into the PC and hit go, and that design's then made. Now, that brings on another problem, quite interestingly.
What's that?
The IP and licensing of products, right? So back in January, it was a 3D system acquired by a company called Gentle Giant Limited, right? Mm-hmm. And they own all the licensing rights to toy franchises like The Hobbit, The Walking Dead, Harry Potter, Alien and Star Wars, right? So you can imagine this time of year that actually what people are using it in a sort of black market is actually to replicate these, say, toy dolls and toy plastic figurines. And they can actually replicate that on a 3D printer and then sell it, obviously, as the genuine article, which it's not. So that can open up a whole new you know, privacy situation with copyright, trademarks, legal complications, you know?
Well, think about, you know, what's happened in, you know, any logo that could be printed onto, I don't know, a T-shirt, a jumper, you know, any form of, you know, dodgy, you know, copy, I guess can be done now. So I guess now that you can do this in a 3D model situation, then anything. You know, you could literally create anything now. So
that's interesting. And another couple, Scott, that kind of stood out to me just when we were talking, because I was kind of thinking about this actually in the car on the way back from the vet. One, obviously, I think about how much heat these things would, you know, if you've got a PC in the office, if you feel the PC, it's hot. You know, the amount of heat that these bits of kit would be exerting within a manufacturing environment, you know, so, and they would be taking a lot of energy, a lot of electricity but combining that, there's got to be some unhealthy air emissions as well that comes out. So, you know, you have to, you know, there's got to be a bit of research done into, you know, how the emissions affect the air and how that would be within a manufacturing environment for people working there.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, and I can only assume it's the same with 3D printing, whereby that, you know, I don't know how many generations worth of 3D printer we've gone through to get to, you know, the stage we're at. But I would assume, you know, there's an element of efficiency will naturally creep in with this as part of the redesign, you know, that will be going on. But whether or not that then leads to an inefficient in the actual, you know, whether companies can do that. But you had a valid point on a pro version of, you know, of 3D printing last week around, you know, you actually, you know, was it Ford was going to design that or did they do create models of that?
The casing, the mould.
So, you know, when you get that kind of scale and, you know, the actual efficiency of it, so you make a model, do you know, that way, which is takes whatever length of time it does to do that, versus all the energy of doing it the old-fashioned way, I guess the efficiency is still probably greater using 3D printing than it would have been without it.
Yeah, and I think what I'm probably more getting to is, you know, if we're having the, you know, looking at investing in big bits of kit with these 3D printers for our manufacturing companies is on the basis of actually all the health and safety is covered round about it, whether that be emissions, heat off it, because I'm guessing, you know, if it's hot enough, you'd have to have some sort of guards, you know, and then that brings in, you know, if these things break down as well, you've got to have the right type of engineers on site who can work with these bits of kit, which I'm guessing, you know, it's not rocket science, but literally if these bits of kit are connected as well through the cloud of things, then actually, you know, you need to make sure that everything's done in the right way and these things can be maintained and fixed if they break down as well. More than just spanners and, you know, this is, then you're talking about more network issues and connectivity problems. So it's going to require a different set of skill set and people to join businesses as well. So it's going to be another investment on top of the printer.
Yeah, and I don't know how desirable a 3D printing, you know, engineer, you know, job versus, I don't know, you know, the other modern, you know, cloud-based roles that are kicking about now, you know, how viable it will be, you know, and how long you're going to have to wait for your 3D printer to get fixed.
Even installed and commissioned, you know, and getting up to speed and running, going through tests and trials. Here's an interesting one. I'm going to throw in a curveball, right? Because we've been talking about sort of making plastics and metal and whatever else. Mm-hmm. But there is a possibility of 3D printed drugs to be made, right? Right. So a researcher, well, the whole purpose of it would be, right, so there was a researcher at the University of Glasgow. They created a prototype of a 3D computer. That's what they call it, right? A computer. I'm guessing chemical computer or whatever. But that makes drugs and medicines. Now, the purpose of it is actually to allow patients to print their own medicines with a chemical blueprint that they get from the pharmacy. So you go to your doctor, you get this prescription, you can then print your own. But right, okay, so we're talking about the problems with 3D printing here. Now, the funny thing is, and of course this is a very long way off, right? Mm-hmm. But actually, people who have been watching the likes of like your Breaking Bad, etc., making homemade drugs, like class A drugs, you know, so actually it could enable DIY chemists like that to create their own class A drugs to sell, you know, like whatever that might be, you know. So,
and maybe design their new drugs as well. Do you know what I mean? They could actually, I don't know if you've ever followed, you know, made a cake or made a recipe. Do you know that way? You decide to, do you know what? I'll throw some of, you know, whatever it is in. Aye, that's gonna, oh my goodness, that's ending.
Yeah, so that's something completely different. So there's a lot of different aspects. Have you noticed any, Scott? Have you seen anything?
Well, just before we move on, isn't that what we would call then more like a food mixer? Do you know that? What's the difference between a 3D printer there than a, you know, than actually the chemical mixing of?
Well, that's a good point, because we're kind of thinking, when I think of 3D printing, I think of exactly what I just said there about the CW plastic models that you would buy. So like a Star Wars character, Luke Skywalker, you can make that in your house. Yeah. Theresa May, John Major, whoever you want, right? You can make them in your house. Oh, you're throwing me off tangent here. Right? So anyway, but actually the funny thing is, imagine you could make your own dinner. Sunday roast, a 3D printer.
Aye, now. But then, how disappointed, and maybe this is the point, right? One of the things, you touched on Star Wars there, one of the things, when I was a kid, I remember looking at Star Wars thinking, do you mean, I don't even know what one it is, whether it's Return of the Jedi or another one, where they end up in the smelly pit on the spaceship. I don't even know what the spaceship's called, but they find themselves in a really smelly place and they're all rubbing their noses and so on. And I thought, and this must have been 30 years ago easily, I'm going, oh, wouldn't it be great to, I don't know, you hit a button on the telly and you could actually smell, you know, what the television folk are smelling at the same time. So
yeah. I think people have tried to do that, though. I remember, Scott, what they were trying to do was they had some sort of, say, like some sort of smoke machine at the back of your telly. And they would do is...
created the ambience of wherever they were, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's quite it. But then that's taking things to another new level. Have you noticed anything else in the 3D printing that could be possibly a problem?
One of the things I was... And this is probably my Scottishness coming out again, whereby... What about the price of them, Terry? I mean, they're not exactly... You can't really pick them up that easily. Well, actually, cost of printer versus quality of, you know, what's the hassle factor worth? Do you know that way? And the other question...
But I think...
Is actually, if you go and buy yourself a brilliant, you know, a top of the range almost, you know, HP printer or, you know, Canon printer, now just a normal, typical printer, but actually the cost isn't the printer. It's the cost of the ink is what than actually the cost of the product. So how much does it cost to run these things versus... I googled, I was on Tech Radar Pro. This time I've done the 10 best 3D printers of 2017, and the price between, you know, kind of £3,000 and a tenner would appear.
So £10 for a 3D printer,
£10 for a Cube Pro Trio, which is the best. There you go, you can get a Cube Pro Trio, best for 3 colour, 3 material printing, and an incredible price.
What can you make on it? Blue tack or something?
You can make
a paper cup.
the bulk, it's a valid point. You know, it's an ideal solution for modelers and engineers who need to create 3D prints with moving parts.
I'm looking for a chocolate block. Put it in there. I need to stick some wires together.
What about if you went and get yourself a Lizbot Taz 6? You know, very fast printing, wide support for materials, but, you know, minuses, it's expensive, £2,100, right? Or, and it's also not the most reliable. So, what chance have you got? You're going to spend your £2,000 and, you know, let's print the supersized Theresa May and it doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm just having a wee look. I mean, have you done any research into the costs for manufacturing companies, Scott? They're buying a big industrial printer.
The one I saw last week, you know, it was serious money, wasn't it? Was it 10? It was like £30,000 or something. I saw one.
And add on another zero on that as well. Yeah. There's one that I would that I'm looking at the minute. So £3,478 complete package. Your 3D printer. It looks all right, you know, but literally what the kind of image they've got is making a basketball hoop, which, you know, for £3,500, I could probably go to Argos, buy a basketball hoop for £20. And everybody's happy. I've still got the same end result.
You're missing the point of that, though, Terry. You don't get the fun out of making the basketball hoop. You know what I mean? That's just...
yeah. So the filament, how much is the filament, Scott?
No idea. Genuinely don't know.
I'm having a wee look. I've just Googled it. So
to see. Yeah.
I mean, this is, guys, what we're talking about is home use, right? Commercial home use that me, you can buy. And it is like fishing line. That's what it looks like. So what it'll do, it'll feed into the 3D printer. And I'm guessing that'll heat it up, melt it, and then it'll work its way into whatever model or whatever you want to make. But looking at this, so for 1.75 metres of this, so this is a 1 kilogram wood filament, for which is a natural wood colour, is £20, £16.81. That's half price.
Doesn't sound
too shabby. Yeah, but then probably the question, Scott, would be how much does 1.75 metres, what does that actually make? Does it make a paperclip or does it make you a George Foreman, you know? What's the sort of, you know, how much do you need to put in? But, eBay's got quite a lot on it. I mean, even Currys is selling it. Currys, click and collect.
It's become so common now. Almost, you know, it was you that was talking about this a few weeks ago, and I'm amazed. I always thought it was, you know, it would have been maybe the universities that would be using this kind of technology, or I used to play rugby with a guy who, that's what he did, actually. He's probably, I wonder, I'll need to catch up with him, because he was actually a model maker. So his job was actually to work with companies to create, you know, hand models of what their products were. So I wonder how he's getting on, because this job that, you know, this product will kill that, I would have thought.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I'm literally, Currys have got advertised a Polaroid Play 3D pen, right? And you can buy this pen, and I mean, it shows you some ridiculous graphics of what you can build out of it for £20. I'd be surprised. It's like a house, and also some sort of, you know, why there's big wheels you go into the shows, Scott, and Alton Towers, and you've got the big wheel, right? London Eye, right? It's basically got an image of the London Eye in miniature scale. I mean, for £20, I don't think you'll be able to build the London Eye, but, you know, for £20, it'd be a good wee stocking filler for Christmas. So that's in Currys. Interesting. Anyway, I digress.
I'm just to kind of back up your point there, I've just typed in Google 3D printing costs, and it's given me a price, cost per cubic inch, all right? And the actual cost of 3D printing is directly proportional to the amount of raft and support required for each pound or kilogram you want to print. The average cost will be in the order of 0.2 to 0.8 dollars per cubic centimeter. So it's about 1.3, it's about a pound per cubic inch is the cost of what it will cost to make something. Doesn't seem silly, does it? You know what?
But then I'm guessing it's the density of the product that you're trying to make as well. So you know, you could be making metal, you could be making, you know, anyway. But interesting, it goes to these as a benchmark. So I think wrapping the 3D printing up, Scott, with regards to the problems, you know, we went through a bit of food for thought there. I think some good topics actually we were discussing at the end. So, you know, the key things to kind of recap are the licensing, the copyright and trademark of products, and how those can be copied quite easily, potentially.
There must be an argument against who, you know, so is it the seller, you know, that actually copyrights against, or is it actually the owner of the 3D printer that's created the fake?
It'll be the owner of the 3D printer that's created the fake, I would guess.
But I'm just thinking, if you say, for example, you went and bought, you know, the £3,000 one or a decent 3D printer, and you fire in the coordinates, and then you come out with something that you know, it's a copy of something.
It's a bit crazy anyway, Scott, because on the basis of kids are getting 3D printers for Christmas, they want to print off Bella or whatever she's called for Frozen, they want to print off whoever, you know what I mean? And actually, you know, so that is a, that's quite a key one. Also, the potential heat and the energy that these type of machines would consume, and the possible, you know, air emissions that would come off it as well, and the actual ability to actually outwith sort of plastic, metal, you know, you could potentially print drugs, which could open up a whole new can of worms as well. So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of positives with 3D printing, and there's also a lot of points to be aware of. And hopefully we've went through, I mean, guys, as I said to you, you know, I was running late today, and I'm kind of, you know, I'm doing this off cuff, and I've left Scott to kind of pull up all the brief that we will tend to go through. And it's typically our briefs tend to be 4 or 5 pages of notes, and we'll chat through it. Scott's did a brief today, 78 pages. And I had 5 minutes to read over it. 78 pages. And that, and 75 of them were on 3D printing. So if anybody wants any information, contact Scott at scott@bonfirerecruitment.com.
Yeah, there's plenty of technical jargon that you said 2 minutes before we started that we probably don't want to go down at that level of detail. So yeah, anyone needs some tech detail, we've got it here.
Okay, so I think that closes off the hot topic this week on the problems with 3D printing. And in this week's Manufacturing Ignition Recruitment Advice, we're going to go through, so once you've got the top candidates engaged in your recruitment process, how should this then be handled when you're meeting face-to-face at interview, regards to going through our stages before you actually make an offer? Scott, what's your input on that?
Yeah, well, we've seen the method that we've done 2017 that's proved highly successful is that we're finding the interviews that are conducted face-to-face, there's already an element of, I'll use the word rapport, but certainly an understanding between, you know, the given client and the given candidate, because we have a full understanding of what the client is looking to achieve, both from the company perspective and from the, you know, what they're looking for the individual to be capable of. But we obviously send, you know, the CV along with a video interview as well. So when the client actually meets with the candidate, that there's already, you know, some common ground, or at least a starting point. Do you know that way? So the majority of the interviews, some of the feedback that we've been learning of this year, has been that things move pretty quickly, and I think that already takes your question to a whole other level. Do you know that way?
Yeah, 100%, Scott. And just to kind of drill into that a little bit further, you know, the main benefit. So once you've engaged and you've struck up a conversation with the top 15%, you've got the person to the point of showing an interest in a particular position with your company, and they're looking to progress that further. The next natural stage that we do is we would then arrange a video interview. The benefit of that actually is a lot of times wasted, both sides. If you meet someone, naturally you think this person's going to be the dream article, the perfect fit, and vice versa for that person, they think it's going to be the dream job and the perfect fit. But actually, in reality, after that initial, you know, 1 hour interview, you know, either side might realise that it's not. And actually, what we do is we do a video interview for all our shortlists, and you can do this as a company as well, where it's a quick 10-15 minute video interview. We will sit down with the person, we will ask that person to go through 5 minutes of their background, and then start asking some key questions like, you know, what's your career aspirations in the next 5 years? Why are you interested in this particular business? Why are you interested in this particular position? That way you get a feel for that person, and they get a feel for you if you're doing the interview.
Yeah.
And vice versa, it's only taken up 15 minutes of your day. Nobody's had to take any holidays. You know, it can be done on an iPhone, it can be done on an iPad, a laptop. It's all done safely and securely. You can lock the room. It's your own personal interview room. And that way, when you're, you know, if that person's actually buying into taking the time, so the candidate, they're buying into taking the time to do a video interview, you know they're not a tire kicker. They're not just looking to get some information from you. They're not just looking to scout. They're actually taking time out of their day. When they weren't looking, you engaged with them. They're taking time out of their day to sit and do a video interview. So that kind of reaffirms their interest in that position. And you will get people who don't turn up for the video interview. And probably the good thing is, thankfully, we never made we never arranged a face to face, because that could be completely time wasting straight away. So good point, Scott. Yeah, with the video interview.
I think also from the client's perspective, it tends to be that the client will invite people that they feel, whether they do or not, it's another question, but they feel that they are relevant for the role and actually would be relevant for their team. Do you know that way? So the client already gets their thought processes, the language that they're talking, and that the methodology of what they're answering, that, you know, the relevant questions that are put to them, which actually could be from the client itself. You know, we do it in some cases where we've got, you know, some key questions that the client wants to be make sure is being presented to the candidate, and see how the candidate reacts, and it's all there. So yeah, it's directly an answer to your question, you know, in terms of, you know, the actual interview techniques and so on. I guess it depends on, you know, what the company is looking to achieve out of their interview as well. Is the company wanting to just get an understanding of, you know, the first stage interview, ticking the boxes from the company point of view, or actually have we already done that? Do you know that way? Do we want to move on to actually be able to bring value for this candidate that's potentially, you know, that isn't, you know, isn't readily available in the market, where what value they could bring to the company? These are all the things that can be discussed.
And exactly. And another tool that we use in addition to the video interviewing is behaviour reports. And I'm sure we've all done them in the past, but it gives you a profile of who you potentially are. Some can be scary, some can be quite, can make you feel uncomfortable. You think, how did that report know me so well in 12 questions? And there's all different types of tools out there. We use a specific tool, you know, you as a business would use a certain tool. But the whole purpose of it is not actually, you know, so we'll get candidates to do a behaviour report. But firstly, what we've done is actually we've got the hiring manager and then possibly the senior team. So say the hiring manager is a managing director of our business. We would get that. We would ask for the MD to do the behaviour test, because then they will understand what the candidate's doing. We will also get as much of the senior leadership team as possible, who would be peer group, to do the test as well. And they can all have a laugh and joke at the reports, etc. But the importance of this is actually when we are submitting candidates, what we'll do is, the candidate will get a copy of their report, but we can actually benchmark the behaviours of that candidate against A, the hiring manager, and then B, the overall team. So you can see actually with this person's behaviour traits, you putting that into your senior leadership team, how the dynamics change within your team. Can I, just let me reiterate here, this is a tool, it's not 100% accurate, it's a tool used where you can actually question people at face-to-face interview, and you can have a real open, upfront, frank conversation, you know, on the basis of, you know, if the hiring manager is more reactive and likes to get things done quick, whilst actually that candidate might be the opposite and actually might be more methodical and might like to take their time before coming to a decision, how they would feel if they were rushed in that sort of situation. It actually allows for a real free-flow, open conversation to make sure that A, both the hiring manager and this person can work well together, and B, that this person would integrate as well as possible within their team. Why would I look at that? Well, the purpose is, a lot of the problems that we get within recruitment and what we've seen historically within the companies is when they make a bad hire, this is, tends to be not the experience or the technical ability of a person. It's more to do with actually that person fitting within their business and their company. So we try and put all the facts and figures in front of the companies that we work with to give them as much tools and understanding to make the best call. And that's the best call for everybody, because what the last thing we want is someone to hand in their notice, take 3 months to start the position, then within a month they realise it's not the right role for them. That leaves a sour taste in that candidate's mouth, as they're now having to look for another role when they've left a secure role. And B, on the client side, actually, do you want to know what? We're back to the drawing board, and we might have to wait another 3 to 6 months to recruit that position, and think about how much cost is involved in that and how much cost is lost as well. You know, and you can't get it right all the time. That's impossible. Yeah. The nature of the beast is we deal with people, you know. It's not a product.
I think an important thing to highlight, Terry, is look, we believe in making sure that the right people get the right job for the right reasons. And I think the only way that we can be, you know, we can only allow that to happen by you know, empowering people to have the tools to do it. Yes, we've got a professional experience. Yes, I'm sure we've got a professional opinions, but actually it's allowing, making sure that the detail and the information is there for, you know, the client and the candidate, you know, to make sure that they're aligned in what's achieving. And as we've seen, you know, it works, do you know, that way, because at the end of the day, if the client is looking to identify this top talent and you've got a candidate that is looking to further a career in a company that's aligned, and also they fit correctly within the team environment, or, you know, the senior management team environment, because through the testing that we've done, whether it's just with the candidate or across their, you know, the senior management team, it works. Do you know, that way? It's tried and tested now. And I think the traditional methods whereby, you know, I know that companies, and they're still there as well, whereby it doesn't matter what level of opportunity you're interviewing at within a company, you will do some form of psychometric testing. But I don't think sometimes that the questioning against the psychometric testing is actually used effectively to allow the candidate to show, you know, to represent themselves fairly, because a candidate may well get stressed out over, you know, the types of questions that are asked. And certainly the way we do it, it's very, it's down to earth, to the point, specific to manufacturing, and it seems to be doing well.
Yeah, and this doesn't replace gut feeling by any means. What it does, it reaffirms that gut feeling, hopefully. Gut feeling is a massive part in the selection process, but actually, if you've got the facts and figures in the black and white to back it up, your decision, and you've got the backing of other members of the senior leadership team, because you know everyone will work well together, yeah, it's a win-win. And remember, this is before we even get to a face-to-face interview, because what you're then getting is the absolute buy-in from that person that they're not going to waste your time. So, Scott, after we've got, you know, after we've done the video interview, we, you know, everybody's happy to proceed. We would then go to a face-to-face and, you know, obviously, Scott, you yourself, if you were in that position where you were approached by someone, you went into a company, how would you like to be treated in the basis? Say you're not actually actively looking, you're happy in your current role, right? But someone's approached you because you're doing a very good job and they're trying to tempt you into their business with, you know, say career progression or more money, whatever it might be, or, you know, how would you like to be treated within a recruitment process to keep you engaged? What would you need to know?
Well, I think, and the important factors for me would be, you know, because if I'm quite happy where I am, and, you know, I would need to be comfortable that there's a reason for me wanting to be, you know, putting my head above the parapet, you know, and meeting with, you know, a given client to speak, you know, about it. As a person, you know, I would need to know the facts and figures and the nitty gritty, I guess, of what's there. But also, I think it's important that whoever, you know, and I guess it would be a recruiter if I was working, you know, wasn't looking, I would need to understand, I would need them to be able to comfortably tell me what their client, you know, is looking, you know, looking for, and to make a self-assessment on whether I'm the right man for doing that or not. And I think that the key thing is to have that information. And the other thing is, on the basis that that's all there, I mean, if I was to go for face-to-face, I think the most important factor is you've still got to treat it as an interview, but likewise, you've got to, and what I mean by that is you've got to do your homework, you've got to do your research in the company and make sure that you're being true to yourself, and that the client knows what you're all about. One concern, or one of the things that tends to happen at interviews, can be that, you know, people, I don't know, act out of character because they don't maybe interview every day, do you know, that way? So they're not, you know, that they find themselves in this tough place where they're trying to impress, but it's maybe not natural to them. And actually, the best advice is, you know, to be actually be yourself and treat it more as a business meeting. Treat it as you would do on a day-to-day basis rather than actually, you know, treating it as a formal interview. That's certainly my approach.
No, I completely agree with you. I think, you know, if it was myself or people that I've dealt with in the past to try and tempt them out of businesses and put them into new businesses, it's very important that end of day, this isn't someone actively looking. So you want to be giving them as much overview as possible. Now, the reason why I mention overview is because you don't want to get too detailed into, you know, confidential information or that sort of stuff. Actually, just, you know, at the end of the day, an overview to give them a good idea of where the role would fit into the business, where the progression opportunities are, because most times these people will be career driven, and actually get maybe a factory tour. That's an important part, because actually what you get in a factory tour is you get, and it's amazing what you can achieve in 10, 15 minutes of walking around the factory, but you do get a sense of the culture. You do get a sense of, you know, simple things like HSE, the products, you know, how the lines are run or whatever that might be. You can pick a lot of good information up. The cleanliness, that's probably a big one for me. You get into a factory, the last thing you want to do is see, you know, you like to see nice painted lines, nice walkways, everything, not, you know, everything in order. And that kind of gives you a reassurance as a candidate that actually, do you want to know what? The companies that invested in the factory, you know, if they're not investing in the small things, then what chances are they investing in the bigger things, and how, you know, that will impact their career. So I think that's an important part as well.
Yeah, and I guess it's relative, isn't it, to the industry? Do you know that way? At the end of the day, the role you could be going for is that there's a company that's now secured investment and they're wanting to get their place ship-shape, do you know that way? But actually, yeah, at the moment, that you know, they're maybe behind the times and they recognise that, and therein lies the opportunity. And that's, you know, I guess that's the beauty of our role, whereby, you know, someone that's maybe comfortable in that environment has maybe seen both sides of that coin. Can actually add significant value to that opportunity. But likewise, if they've worked in a shiny factory all their life, then, you know, looking at the industrial situation of maybe 30 years ago is maybe not the best environment for them. So you're right. Yeah. I mean, it's knowing what you're working with, isn't it? You're knowing what you're playing with in your job and doing it well.
Yeah. So I think summarising that particular recruitment minute would be in the basis of, you know, at the end of the day, you know, make sure that we're weeding out tyre kickers straight away, you know, conducting a good video interview, getting a feel for the candidate, gets a feel for the business and vice versa. That way you can progress with somebody you feel comfortable with without wasting time and money. Secondly, a behaviour report would be very useful, especially within the senior team. Because what you can actually do is actually line up some really relevant interview questions, once again saving time and money, where you can probe right in an interview and make sure it's a good fit for all parties from a culture point of view. Now, remember, behaviours can change. So this isn't, you know, as I said to you, it's just used as an interview technique rather than a hiring decision. And if anyone wants any advice into specific software that we use for video interviewing or specific, the specific programs that we use for our behaviour reports, please let us know and drop us a line. So it's terry@bonfirerecruitment.com or scott@bonfirerecruitment.com.
Just on the point you were saying there, we've actually done it whereby we've actually, that the client had invested in their own programme for recruitment and their own internal setup, but they didn't actually have the tool for doing the behavioural assessment. So that can be done separately.
Yeah, I'm more than happy to give them the advice on that. But so that wraps up this week's podcast, Scott. How did you find it broken into three different chunks?
Well, it's good. I think we need to spend a bit more time on making sure we can count to three. But once we've got that sorted, then I think it'll be a lot easier listening on everyone, I think, whereby you can actually listen to the part that's important to their world at the point in time. So yeah, all good.
Yeah. Good. So if you're listening to the end of this particular podcast, just remember there's two other podcasts that we'll discuss. So every week we have three separate podcasts. One, the latest manufacturing news from that previous week. And the second one being a specific hot topic within manufacturing. And then the third podcast being the recruitment advice for a specific issue or area for development. That myself and Scott will go through. Those are cut down into bite-sized chunks of 10, 15, sort of 20 minutes long, depending on the specific topic. So if you haven't listened to them in the past, please check us out on iTunes by searching Manufacturing Ignition Podcast or SoundCloud, and you can have a listen there. We've had a number of emails coming in with some good feedback. We're always looking to improve what we're doing and give some really useful advice. So if anybody's got any more feedback, that would be great. You can pop us an email, as I said, to terry@bonfirerecruitment.com or scott@bonfirerecruitment.com. Thanks for tuning in this week, and we will speak to you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Manufacturing Ignition podcast. If you've made it this far, we take it that you enjoyed the show. In return, we'd love it if you'd leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Subscribe while you're there, and we'll catch you for the next episode.